Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday on April 27th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, thanking the nurses, clinical teams, and the entire staff at Saratoga Hospital for the care they provide. Saratoga Hospital, people you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us on the line today is virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He is ready to take your questions about the coronavirus. We anticipate plenty of calls on this program. Call early if you have a question. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Eric Yeager, your call's coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager's research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. He explores the impact of aging on immunity, which is relevant at this time in our national history. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Ray. Thank you for having me. I hope you and your family are well and healthy.
We are doing fine. And how about yourself?
Well, thank you. Kind of getting a little cabin fever, but doing well. Thank you.
Are you still doing the distance learning for your students?
Yes, it's our last week of classes before finals, and I have to say the students have adapted magnificently. So they've been troopers. They're dealing with a lot of off-campus stuff for some of the students, but they've really powered through, students and faculty both.
Well, that's fine for the students. What about the professors?
It's been initial challenges, but we really pulled it through. We were lucky at the college I'm at, the College of Pharmacy. We have fantastic staff that had some distance learning set up or on plan. So we were able to kind of adapt and roll with things quickly, and we were able to continue with classes this semester. We're going to continue into the summer as well, and hopefully by fall we'll be on campus live.
Outstanding. Governor Cuomo today mentioned in his briefing that 14.9% of those tested statewide tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies. In New York City, the number is closer to 25%. What does that tell you, and does it automatically mean there's immunity?
So it's good that they have the tests available. So the two tests really at our disposal for this infection is molecular tests and serological tests. So the molecular tests, as we've talked about previously, are looking for the virus's blueprint, its RNA. And with those kind of tests, you typically have to have an active infection. So if you're someone that was asymptomatic, didn't think much of it, and this is like maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, that test is likely not going to pick up the virus. Where the serological test, it's kind of like a fingerprint that you've been exposed to the virus and your body made a response. So these tests are telling us kind of what we assume, that there was a large proportion of the population exposed, many of those who could have been asymptomatic. I should caution that the numbers are still on the low side. These tests are highly sensitive and they're highly specific, but there's still like a 1 to 5% chance that there's a false positive rate. So there's still some issues to be worked out with what really are the numbers. But I think it is, I'm glad we have these. It's going to actually help us figure out what is the true exposure rate and what is our true fatality rate.
And will this, in fact, help us to figure out the immunity rate? In other words, there is some discussion that says, okay, yeah, you might have the antibodies. That doesn't mean you can't get it again.
Right. And the World Health Organization put out, I think it was Friday or Saturday, put out kind of this statement about immunity that was kind of alarming. And really what it was meant to, I think the intent there was to say, we don't know enough yet. So we can't say if antibodies are protective or not protective. We have to really do some more studies to find out really what is correlates of protection. The only data we have thus far is a couple small animal studies and some individual studies of can we detect the antibodies. And we can measure it based on what's called titers. So presumably the more of a response you make, the higher the titer, the more protective you'll be. So that's something that has to be done. In the animal studies, it looks like animals were protected when they were affected from this virus and exposed a second time. So that suggests that antibodies could be protective. And then lastly, there's some of those rollout studies looking at convalescent serum, where antibodies have been collected from people that have recovered from the illness. And when given to people that are having severe forms of disease, those people have improved. So there's hope that immunity can be generated, but we don't yet know enough what is the level you need to be protected.
Nevertheless, a 25% exposure rate in New York City must be heartening to some extent in that the death rate then drops.
Yeah, that's the big plus there. If we really find out the number of people, that death rate that we feared was, 7 to 10% really is, any death, of course, is tragic.
Yes.
You want to avoid one death. But it does bring a bit more calm in terms of, okay, this is a disease that, it's not still, there's that kind of misinformation at first. Oh, it's just another flu, nothing to be worried about. It still is, tenfold higher fatality rate as of now within the current numbers we have. The fatality rate is still much higher than seasonal flu, but any decrease we can get is happy in my estimation.
Putting aside the societal things we have done to reduce the spread, what, as a virologist, what have you learned that you can take forward to the next potential pandemic?
I think definitely the behavior aspect is key, because both for the prevention, but also, unfortunately, these viruses arise because of human behavior. So because of impacts of deforestation, agricultural practices, and even some impacts of climate change, these viruses, they're not new to the world. They've been around forever, and they just happen to, come up to cause disease in us. So I think it's learning how to adapt and deal with these on a much quicker level. These kind of viruses, again, they need an animal reservoir, so it's finding out what animals can carry those. So I think the information we're gathering currently, and I there's so much information on a daily basis, it's kind of funny. It's ever-evolving. So I give talks or I answer questions to students, and basically I have to preface it by saying that what I'm telling you today could be different tomorrow.
What do we know, in fact, about the origin of this? What is new? I mean, there is a swirl of information and misinformation and perhaps disinformation about where this began and how it began. What's the latest?
So the latest, still the genetic information. So because we have the tools we have to identify the viruses, all viruses based on their blueprint, their genetic material, we had information about the blueprint that made up the SARS-CoV-2 virus rather quickly. And from that, scientists could look to see where exactly this virus came from. And similar to other coronaviruses like the original SARS and the MERS virus, it's thought to first, it's a zoonotic disease, so it starts in an animal. So this one is definitely a bat origin virus. And it's still uncertain what animal was the intermediary between the bat and us. But it's clear that there was some intermediary that allowed the virus to jump. And I know there's been kind of back and forth. Well, was it at this market in China? Was it a laboratory accident? I think there's scientific data to definitely support the idea this is not a man-made virus for a couple of reasons. First, because of the similarity it bears to other related bat coronaviruses. And secondly, it's the way that the virus adapted to bind to our cells. So you remember I talked about the key in the door, getting into the right door.
Right.
So that wasn't predicted by what we knew about viruses at the time before this virus came out. So it kind of used some different rules that we weren't aware of. So it is certainly a natural virus. Exactly where that first case occurred and how it was spread through parts of China is still uncertain.
Does that matter?
I don't think it matters much. I think it's more, kind of Monday morning quarterbacking. I think it's more the virus is here. We have to deal with it. And what are the right approaches to control it? And then like you had mentioned, Ray, learning from that. So like if a virus like this comes up again, we can deal with it in a much quicker and effective fashion.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. The phone lines are loading up here. We'll get to the calls in a moment. 800-348-2551 is our number, and we'll be right back. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. We're lucky to have Dr. Eric Yeager back with us today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Oh, yeah, we saw you on TV, but we had you here first. So we're pretty proud of that. All right, this email came in, and then we'll get to the phones. This is from Bonnie in Sand Lake, and an interesting question. Bonnie writes, our family rents small cottages well-spaced during the summer at Lake George. What do we need to do to make sure they are adequately cleaned between guests? We often only have a few hours between visitors. Can we make this safe for others and also not spread coronavirus upstate?
That's a great question Bonnie has. And I think we're all thinking about that as we get closer to reopening or rolling reopenings. What does that mean to how we have to change daily business practices? And I think for Bonnie's with her cottages and tourism is definitely something that is important for our state.
Yeah.
The CDC has really good references as to the types of cleaning products that have been shown to eliminate the virus or clear the virus. So I think it's one, the good part is being in the open air is going to help circulate the air. Second, the warmer weather is going to help. Now it's not going to eliminate the virus completely. It does make it a little bit more challenging to be transmitted, we hope. But using those cleaners, and I think cleaning every surface that could someone have a common contact with, doorknobs, tables, and things like that. I'm sure there'll be additional recommendations that'll come out by the governor and the Department of Health to ensure that places are as clean as possible. And really, then it also comes down to the person that is renting, that they're also following their own precautions as well to maintain their safety.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, our guest. Tom in Bristol, Vermont. Tom, you're up first.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Dr. Yeager. Hi. I'm a retired guy. Very well, thanks. And no symptoms. And I like to go biking and go biking with a couple of friends. And I'm just wondering how safe it is to do that.
That is a question that hits close to home. I'm an avid biker myself, and usually I bike alone, but thinking about like competitions I had planned, how best to do that safely. And there's been some studies, more computer-based than really actual real studies, to see how far back you have to be from someone when you're biking. If you're sweating, if it's like a pretty rigorous ride, if you're sweating and breathing heavily, and you unfortunately did have the virus and were asymptomatic, what would the exposure rate be? And it seems like biking at certain speeds and having the particles come from you to hit someone that's behind, the distance is even more than 6 feet that we hear for social distancing. It's almost like three or four times that, which of course makes bike rides a little less social. So I think it's more spacing. If you can, it's not always easy to do with certain roads to kind of go side by side rather than have someone behind you. So I think the best way to do it, because it is going to be challenging to wear a mask as you're biking at all times because you're breathing a bit heavy, is to, if you could space out from front to back pretty far, again, maybe even like 20 feet, or if you can space the 6 feet side to side and kind of limit talking until we know a little bit, know a bit more about transmission from other mechanisms. I think that's the safest way to do it.
Yeah, we tend to go on rides that are at least an hour long, maybe
yeah.
Two. We'll be averaging about 14 miles per hour. But of course, some of those, sometimes you'd be going a lot faster, sometimes you're going a lot slower. So,
right. All right.
So, yeah, I think it's kind of the same thing. And my father-in-law is a golfer. It's kind of the same thing. We have these activities that part of the fun is the interaction and the social aspect of it. So it's still being able to do that in the safe distance. I think with the biking part, maybe not as talking as much during the ride, maybe kind of talking at the end of the ride or right before, maintaining that social distancing. I think it'll be safe, but I think it's just making sure there's spacing between bikes.
Tom, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences with us today. Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim.
What about the possibility of transmission of the virus through heating and cooling systems?
Okay. Did you catch that, Eric?
I did. In terms of like HVAC systems, the filters that are used, I'm not a HVAC person, so I won't pretend to go too deep into it. I do know a little in terms of the filters that are in the units. They should be able to capture particulates. I don't know for certain if there's any extra precautions you'd have to make in terms of cleaning them. Again, I think with the warmer weather, people are hoping if you can open doors, there's a greater chance of airflow in rooms, that it does help with any kind of particulates that are moving around that might reduce room-to-room transmission. But in terms of anything extra you would do with those systems, I'm not sure. If you're someone that's working on them, I guess I would recommend the precautions of a face mask and making sure your hands are washed, you don't touch your eyes, nose, or mouth while you're working on it. But outside of that, I can't think of anything else additionally.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, and Harriet is in Woodstock. Harriet.
Hi. Hi there.
Hi.
So I actually have two questions. One is, I've noticed on television recently that there's a call for blood from the Red Cross. And I'm wondering about, actually not the virus, but Lyme disease. They test for Lyme disease with a blood test. So it must be present in the blood. And I believe there's many hundreds, if not thousands, of people who actually have Lyme disease and don't have not been diagnosed. I'm wondering about the transmission of Lyme disease through a blood transfusion.
So with all blood that's collected, the Red Cross does a number of tests to ensure that there are not any known pathogens there. So Lyme would be a test. The current SARS-CoV-2 virus would be tested as well. So they're testing the two tests that we started the show off with, the molecular test and the serological test. So if you were someone that's actively infected, they could potentially detect the presence of the Borrelia causing the Lyme disease or the virus causing COVID-19, or they would test for the presence of antibodies. So if you were exposed previously to Lyme or to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So there still is a need for donations, and that's why they're on television, because of course things are all with people sheltering in place, there's less people donating, and there's still a need for blood. We talk a lot about cases of infections in hospitals, but there's still people that need blood transfusions on a daily basis. So that with people not donating as much, there's a dramatic decrease in the blood supply. So the Red Cross will, I am certain, I don't work with them, but I'm certain they have tests to ensure that the blood is safe to give to individuals.
Harriet, thank you very much for the call. But that brings up an interesting point. Now, you have mentioned this, I believe you call it convalescent serum.
Yeah, correct.
That's plasma, right? So that is not the whole blood.
Right. So they can fractionate out the red blood cells and other proteins in your blood. What they want are these Y-shaped molecules called antibodies. And those are the things your bodies will produce when you're exposed to microbes or germs. And these antibodies are intended to protect you during the active infection, but also to protect you if you were reinfected.
Mm-hmm.
So so the convalescent is a person that was infected. Now, they may not have had a test, a molecular test, but they probably had symptoms consistent with COVID-19. They, at least a 14-day period, their symptoms have resolved. They seem better. So they'll collect their blood. They'll isolate out and they'll isolate out those antibody molecules, and they want to test, can that be used as a therapy, both for individuals that are sick in the hospital or potentially as something to give to medical personnel and first responders until a vaccine is available.
All right, back to the phones we go. Dr. Eric Yeager, so nice to join us for an hour this afternoon. 800-348-2551 is the number. Vanessa in New Paltz. Vanessa.
Hi, I'm calling to find out how long a patient who's been diagnosed with COVID is contagious?
That's a great question. The numbers I see is they typically mention someone that's been 14 days past their fever has been broken or they show any of the major list of symptoms consistent with COVID-19. Now, there are a few cases anecdotally where patients have been tested with the molecular test and they see that they're positive for the RNA. But that doesn't, it's a difficult test because that test does not tell live versus dead virus. It only says the virus genetic material or its blueprint is there. It doesn't tell if that person is actively shedding infectious virus. So there's still a little more work to be done there. But most of what I've read, it seems like the 14-day period where a person is free of symptoms is potentially not shedding.
All right, Vanessa, thank you very much. Now, when we get a normal flu shot or a pneumonia shot, those viruses are dead?
They're, well, Depends on the vaccine. So the traditional vaccine, the one you get in the shot, the flu shot in the arm, is the virus has been grown up. It has been inactivated or killed. And then the virus is then injected into the body, and your body sees it as foreign, and your body makes those Y-shaped molecules, those antibodies against it. There's a second type of flu vaccine, which is used in a small proportion of the population, for young children to anywhere and to people up to the age of 49. It's called the flu mist. So that is a weakened virus, and it gets injected by a nasal spray into the nose, and that also elicits antibodies.
Mm.
Now, those are the two approaches. In terms of vaccines, scientists are trying, and the last I looked, there's 5 clinical trials and over 70 experimental trials on vaccines against COVID-19 alone. Some of those are very similar to the flu shot you get, where it's an inactivated form or a piece of the virus. And there may be ones that have a weakened virus that contains pieces of the COVID-19 virus. So there's a variety of different formulations being tested, but it's still too early to determine which one is going to be effective.
What is the difference between a clinical trial and an experimental trial?
So an experimental trial, it's done in a laboratory. It's done with it's probably done with animals and animal cells, maybe some human cell lines, but it's not gone out into the clinic, and it has not been tested on humans. So the clinical trials, you might hear the terminology in the news, is phase 1, 2, 3, and 4. So most of the vaccines start out in a laboratory, like the lab I'm working in. We try out different approaches. If we get a sense that it works in a culture system or in a laboratory animal system, then it looks like perhaps it is worth trying in bigger studies. So you move from the animal studies to clinical studies. And then the clinical studies will establish first, is the vaccine candidate safe to use? If it's safe and it's not going to cause any harmful effects to the patient, then is it effective? Is it going to elicit an immune response that can protect? So normally these vaccine studies that go from experimental to clinical can take decades. We're kind of speeding through relative to past vaccines with the idea of a 12 to 18 month time frame, because some of the information we got on the virus we've experienced before with other coronaviruses like the SARS virus of 2003, plus having the blueprint of this current virus, it's allowed us to kind of shave a little bit of the time off, but we still have to go through those clinical studies to make sure it's safe and then effective.
Do you think that the 12 to 18 month prediction is too optimistic?
It's on the shorter end. I think really what we have to strive for is, I want a vaccine tomorrow like everyone else. I want to be able to feel safe and to go out and not be concerned about passing the infection to my loved ones. But paramount to that is a vaccine that is safe and not going to cause more harm and cause a second public health problem. Additionally, I worry we don't want to erode any confidence that people have in science and vaccines any further than we have some already.
Is your lab doing any work on this?
Tangentially, we're looking more at how the virus, viruses like this virus. So I work on viruses that are RNA viruses that have envelopes. So viruses in some respects similar to COVID-19 or the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And we are starting out to venture out into this virus as well. It is a bit more challenging to work with, of course. So my collaborator and I are looking at ways to understand what it needs inside the cells and can we develop drugs. But my studies would be considered kind of the basic laboratory studies, well removed from clinical as of yet.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And let's go to Chuck in Latham. Chuck.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask about virus mutations. I read recently that we've detected over 30 different strains of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And I wanted to know, as a virologist, how that impacts the testing, with the Cygnus tests and the antibody tests. Are they sensitive to the different strains? And then how does that impact potential immunity moving forward against possible other strains that maybe you weren't infected with? And then similarly, is it possible to, what's the likelihood of receiving, of actually getting an infection with multiple strains simultaneously? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks a lot for the call.
All right. Thanks, Chuck. Those are some good points. So there has been some more in-depth studies on, are there different mutations? And mutation, we commonly think of a mutation always being worse, but with these viruses, particularly RNA viruses, mutation is just part of their life. The way they replicate, they're making copies of their blueprints inside cells, mutations occur. And not all mutations lead to increased lethality, increased pathogenicity, or the likelihood of causing disease. So the paper Chuck mentioned is a peer, it hasn't been quite peer reviewed yet, but it does bring up information that there could be potentially 30 different strains. And that was a very small study looking at 11 patients in China. And they did sequencing to look at basically the letters that make up the blueprints of the virus. And they did notice that there were differences in these letters, and that in the laboratory setting, these, some of these viruses appeared to infect cells better and maybe replicate better. Now, I should caution that first, this is a laboratory setting, so it's in a cell line. It's not in the context of a human body or a human immune system. So often what we'll find in a laboratory setting in a cell culture dish isn't always replicated in the real world.
Why? In other words, those cells are alive, right?
They're alive, but there's a lot of variables, important variables that are removed. So in addition to the virus mutating, there's also the selective pressure by the human race, and it's our immune system. So the virus is going to mutate only if it helps the virus evade our immunity.
Yeah.
In this cell culture system, you're removing kind of any adaptation. It's just a cell. There's no immune system. You're also making it easier for the virus to infect the cell because you don't have to sneeze into the tissue culture dish, killing the cells. You're actually just dropping the virus right in, so you're facilitating the infection.
Yeah.
So that is removing a critical step. So there's a lot that goes on before the cell gets infected that this study isn't looking at. It does support the notion that yes, these viruses do mutate as we. It's not unexpected. What we do know is that the rate of mutation is 2 to 4-fold less than the flu viruses. And that's important because with our flu viruses, because of how they mutate more quickly, we have to develop a new vaccine every year to kind of stay ahead of the virus.
Mm.
So even though these coronaviruses could mutate, the idea is that it's slow and it may not be something that's going to be problematic when we develop vaccines. The other thing I should mention too is that the virus is already evolved to be very good at what it does. It's evolved to bind to our cells, has the right key to get into our cells, go through that lock very easily. It doesn't need to get any better at it. So it's something that we expect, and there's yet to be any kind of large switch that I've seen in the data that there's a large change in one strain to the next. So this is just something that happens in a natural population of viruses.
And a mutation doesn't necessarily mean it will become a stronger virus, right?
Correct. It could weaken the virus. And over time, what they've noticed with other viruses, not only with coronaviruses, but viruses tend to, over time, as they go through a population, they kind of become less pathogenic. Because really, the virus's job is to infect a cell, make more copies of itself, and go on to the next cell or next person. It doesn't benefit it, honestly, to cause disease, because if the person becomes ill and is unable to interact with other people, the virus can't be passed from person to person. So disease is not the goal of the virus. It's unfortunately a consequence of the infection. And often, as with this virus, the more severe cases are thought to be our immune response to that virus overreacting. Now, in terms of being infected by more than one strain, we don't know enough yet about co-infection. We don't know enough about, in terms of antibodies, if people can become reinfected. There's some anecdotal evidence that some individuals appear to be reinfected, but we have to caution that because we don't know if the initial test result showing that they were infected was a true result or a false positive.
Hmm.
So the mutation is a little concerning, and in terms of when you hear the word mutation, and I know the governor has talked a lot about in his press conferences the past week or so about the second wave, and the second wave is not the wave that we saw if we go back in history to the 1918 pandemic. There were two waves, and the virus was more lethal in the fall than it was in the spring in early summer. And it's thought that what happened was the virus in that case, because flu does mutate much more quickly and it has other ways to mutate and recombine, that it became much more effective and lethal at its job. And that's why there was a more problematic second wave. But with this virus, the second wave the governor is mentioning is not necessarily a wave of a different strain. It's just that there is still, even though 21% or 25%, whatever numbers come out to be for the serological tests, that still means that 3 out of 4 people have yet to be exposed.
So far, 7,500 people right. only have had their antibodies tested. And so we could theoretically see that number go higher.
It could also go down. We have to, because it was a small number, there's a concern. I think it was done randomly. There's been some other studies out in California that perhaps they're their method of securing volunteers for their serology might have been a little bit skewed towards people that thought they were exposed. And then if you're going towards places where you expect the virus to be anyway, you're going to find a higher number compared to the serology up here, I think was maybe 3%. There's less cases up here. So there's still, you know, the second wave really has to deal with, there's still a large number of people in the population that have yet to be exposed. So likely don't have antibodies, and they're not going to have those antibodies until they're exposed or until there is a vaccine made available.
Dr. Eric Yeager. We're going to take a quick break here, sir, and we're a minute overdue, but then we'll come right back. We'll pick it up and get back to the phones as well. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Ray Graff here, 800-348-2551, the number. Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences joins us. And before we hit the phones hard here at the end of the program, one email. This one is from Mike. Mike writes, would Epigen help in infected patients? But Epigen, it's anemia, right? That's a lowers the number.
I'm not familiar with what that is, that particular drug. Called Epigen.
E-P-O-G-E-N. I think it's an anemia drug.
Oh, let's see. So if it looks like it's a compound that increases red blood cells. I mean, it could. I mean, what I think with most of the patients that are severe, again, I'm not a clinician, and I can't recommend anything,
right.
Of course. With this, I mean, the major case of the disease is no severe cases. There's a large amount of inflammation in the airways, and it's causing a lot of swelling and tissue damage, making it difficult for patients to breathe. So that's lowering the blood oxygen. So I guess anything that could increase the ability of the blood oxygen to increase. But if any drug, there's also side effects too. I've read a number of studies where in those severe cases where individuals have been intubated for a series of days or weeks, clinicians are trying all sorts of therapies to improve their outcomes.
Yeah.
From turning them on their side, from different types of therapies of recirculating the blood, anything they can to get these people that are not responding, where the machines are cranked up almost to 100% or at 100% supplying their oxygen. So I wouldn't be surprised that Epigen may have been tried for some patients. But really the body in some of these cases, it's so inflamed, there's so much going on that it's kind of a black box still with what really therapy is going to work.
You know, with media and multimedia and social media, I have never seen so many different remedies and ideas floated around. This morning, we had a newsroom TV on and there was no sound, but the bottom of the screen said heartburn medication being touted as a possible cure for coronavirus. And I thought, well, I'm glad the sound isn't up, but have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, I heard a little bit about this before I came on. Some of the active components of Pepcid for heartburn medication, there's some suggestion that perhaps it could impact the viral life cycle. Again, one benefit we have is that since we've known about coronaviruses for decades,
yeah,
we've been able to study them. Again, this virus itself is new and novel to us, but we know a bit about the life cycle of these viruses. So it's fortunate that we're in the era that we're in now because we have pharmacists, we have clinicians, epidemiologists, and basic scientists that are looking at all these different approaches and trying out all these things from using heartburn medication to, I heard on NPR this weekend, taking pantyhose and tightening a mask around your face. So there's really these older remedies that are, you know, in some cases you might laugh them off, but there's some factuality to them. And with these drugs now, since there is no FDA-approved drug for this virus, everything's being looked at because you never know. Now, again, you don't want to, you know, caution really. These are being tested in studies in the laboratory typically. You know, we're far from the point of saying, okay, go out to the drugstore and just try taking Pepcid HD.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of ran into that when hydroxychloroquine was first being prescribed. People were trying to get some of that medication before. Again, as Dr. Fauci said, we really need to have controlled studies because anecdotal is really just not what we need to be at. We need to be at controlled studies that are randomized, that we have control groups to say, yes, this drug works for a particular population.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Fred is in where? Fred, you're on.
Hello, Ray, and hello, doctor. How are you?
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
I have a question about the coronavirus. You see, my impression is that most of the fatalities are with people who get the infection in their lungs and can't breathe and that sort of thing, need to be intubated. Is that true, that the vast majority of the deaths are from that? And also, does it make a difference whether you are exposed through breathing in the virus or getting it into your body through your mouth or some other way? Will it still end up in your lungs either way, or is it mainly getting to the lungs by breathing in the virus?
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that most of the cases, people that are hospitalized in the severe cases, the virus has traveled down into the lower respiratory tract into the lungs, causing a large amount of inflammation and damage. So the virus is typically still, you're talking about different ways you can get sick from this or get infected by this virus. And still the predominant way is inhalation of infectious droplets. If you touch an infected surface, you could certainly touch your eye, your nose, your mouth, and the virus can still get in that way. But what happens is it does eventually get to, in some cases, the lower airways. And those are the individuals that they start off with fever, they have trouble breathing, they'll be hospitalized. And then, again, we need more study that has to be done about really what is the pathogenicity. Like, we can definitely identify the symptoms. We can definitely identify people that undergo this acute respiratory distress syndrome that people have. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, a lot of it is thought to be the body's response against the virus. So there's symptoms, but really what exactly is causing that is kind of the million-dollar question. If we knew what exactly was causing patients to go from being asymptomatic, no problem, to a patient that has a mild disease, no problem, to those patients that can go severe and at a risk for fatal disease, it's still going to take a bit more studying. There are certainly underlying health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, respiratory issues that predispose people, obesity, that predispose people to severe outcomes. But there's not, unfortunately, one substance we can say, if we were able to just block that, boy, we could stop severe disease.
Fred, thanks for the call. Over to Maria in North Adams. Maria.
Hi. My question is, why do we never hear about it in Canada? Are they doing something right?
There are cases globally. There are cases everywhere. I don't think it's necessarily that Canada is doing something better than we're doing. They may have had a different response initially, but they certainly have hospitalizations. They're certainly having fatalities. I just think that there's, it's kind of what's happening in your own yard, then your neighbor's backyard. If there's a fire, you don't really, you're going to focus on the fire in your yard. So I think we're just focused on what we're dealing with in New York. But certainly there are cases worldwide, and Canada is no different.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We go to Gary in West Haven, Vermont. Gary.
Hi. I'm a manic depressive. Does depression make a happy home for the virus? And the second part would be, I use hydrogen peroxide, one part to 25 parts of water in my humidifier set at 25. And I've run it like that for a long time, and I haven't died yet.
Well, that's good for you. All right, what do you think, doctor?
Well, hope you're well, Gary. In terms of mental conditions, I mean, certainly there's been studies looking at disease and individuals that are suffering from anxiety or depression, and there's sometimes an increased incidence. With this particular illness, what's been linked so far looks to be heart disease, diabetes, and obesity. In terms of the peroxide, I think it's keeping certainly your humidifier clean. Whether it's its ability to act against the virus in your body is probably negligible or zero. It's really just keeping your humidifier clean from bacteria, because of course it's not just the virus you want to worry about. It's fungal spores and bacteria that can collect in standing water. So I would continue with making sure that your humidifier is cleaned.
All right, Gary, thanks so much for the call. Scott in Albany. Scott, you're up.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. This is kind of a governance meets medical question.
Right.
Maybe it's more suited for the round table. But my question is that in a limited resource situation like we've got now, how do we prioritize testing versus tracing? It seems like,
Governor Cuomo is trying to deal with that issue right now. So that's a good question.
Yeah, so first, make sure we have enough tests. And then once we do that, we really have to move into contact tracing. So the audience may have heard that through the news, the governor's press conferences, and certainly other countries that are a little bit farther along than us are starting to do that. And really that involves is if you have enough tests, you first identify the person that clearly has the infection. And then you have a way to identify those people to come in contact with. And it does get a little bit of kind of governance involved, because it's how best can you identify those people that you've come in contact with? It's
right. That seems like a high resource investment for contact tracing versus instead of testing 50% of everybody, just test 100% of everybody.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's certainly that the testing capacity, even if we were able to make that number of tests, there's still the backlog and having people to analyze the test. The contact tracing is going to certainly take a large effort, and it's going to be a challenge. It's going to involve people that are doing investigative work on the ground. So if I came down ill, did I go to the gas station? Did I go to the grocery store? And notifying all those people to, hey, watch yourself for symptoms.
Yeah.
So some countries are really kind of using cell phones or using apps. I think there was another story I heard on NPR this weekend where China's using some very, some almost like Orwellian.
Invasive to the
track,
max.
Right.
Yes. And then there you go. This is a fine line and another show completely.
Right.
But anyway, Scott, thanks a lot for the call. And I believe there are some medical people from, I think, the Bush administration and also the Obama administration who are calling for $46 billion for contact tracing. So we will probably see that in the next stimulus package from Congress.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mandy in East Greenbush. Mandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question. I use a neti pot for when I have my spring allergies. Would that have any impact on the virus, like flushing out the virus or not?
Hmm. No. So unfortunately, there's nothing. There's been some kind of stories out there with flushing or using warm air or warmed water. And really, once the virus attaches to your cells, it gets inside. So it's not like a bacteria that stays potentially outside that you could flush out. But the virus gets inside cells. And those cells are not going to be removed by the neti pot. Additionally, in some cases, your body producing mucus, as uncomfortable as it is to get a stuffy nose. In some cases, the mucus is actually helping you fight off the infection, which raises another point. Allergy season's coming up, so we have to kind of be aware of the symptoms of what's an allergy symptom, what's the COVID-19 symptom, and making sure that clinicians, can advocate rightfully which one you're suffering from.
All right, Mandy, thank you very much. Yeah. Let's go to Roger in Adams. Roger, you're up.
Hi.
Hey.
My question is about the effects of items in your refrigerator or your freezer. Does that, assuming that there's some virus on an item that you put into your refrigerator or freezer, does it have an effect on it, and how long?
Okay.
So there, so the virus, they've done studies at least on other objects, not frozen food, unfortunately, but on cardboard and metal, and they have a sense for how long the virus can last on those substances. The virus being enveloped, so it has a outer coating. Again, if you remember me describing a virus as kind of this candy shell covered by this droplet of fat.
Right.
Those viruses tend to be a little less stable in the environment. So freezing long-term, the virus isn't going to be very happy. It would render it not as infectious. But that'll happen just with time itself, because the virus needs to get inside a cell. It's the only way that it can replicate. It's not like a bacteria that can replicate on its own. So if it's not in a cell, it's going to eventually die off. That doesn't mean like you should throw yourself in a freezer or anything like that. I think really the main mode, and I should stress too, the main mode of infection is going to be respiratory. So if you are breathing in droplets from someone that is sick, that's why we have the mask mandate to prevent that exposure route. And if you have food, and a number of people, even myself, get food on takeout, it's just keeping your hands washed, making sure you don't touch your nose, eyes, and mouth after eating.
All right, Roger, thanks a lot. And now over to Kingston, New York, and Carla. Carla, you have about a minute here.
Okay, Dr. Yeager, when you go to give blood and they test for Lyme disease, do they use the Western blot or do they have something better now?
So the Western blot, from my understanding, is still the test that's used. So for your listeners, there's two types of serological tests. The one that is just being rolled out for COVID-19 is kind of a called an ELISA-based test. It's looking for a single antibody response. Is it a plus or a minus? The Western blot is a more elaborate test. It actually characterizes a person's total antibody response against the pathogen. And because Lyme disease is so tricky to diagnose, often the Western blot is used to get a better confirmation. They haven't switched that for COVID-19 yet. They don't have the capability to do that. Maybe in the future they will. But certainly the Western blot, still, I believe that is still the test that's used for Lyme.
Thank you, Carla, very much. And now we go to Gene in Poughkeepsie. Gene, about 30 seconds here.
Hi there. Thanks for the call. Quick question. Is there any advantage or disadvantage to face washing after you've done the 20-second hand washing?
So I think hygiene itself, so definitely hand washing. You want to do the full 20 to 30 seconds. There's a lot of videos on how to do it effectively. Listen to your favorite song. Certainly, you do want to clean, your face. If you had any chance to have in contact with anything, it's always good to be sanitary in other parts of the body. Importantly, too, if the face, I think most important is it, because we're wearing masks a lot more, is to make sure that you take the mask, you put the mask on and off the right way, making sure you don't touch your face after touching your mask. And if you do, then definitely wash your face.
Well, Dr. Eric Yeager, that's where we will have to leave it. Once again, thank you for being here, sir. And we'll probably, before this is all over, get you back one more time at least, all right?
Yep, happy to join, Ray. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
You again.
Support comes from Hudson Valley Cancer Genetics, providing cancer risk assessment, genetic testing, and consultations for patients, survivors, and their family members, serving the entire Hudson Valley. HudsonValleyCancerGenetics.com. Once again, thanks to the great Dr. Eric Yeager for being with us today. So informative, always, and somehow comforting in these strange times. Also comforting is Zach Malloy, our engineer. He's wearing a mask, but he's comforting. Kayleen White took your calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, this is exciting, folks. 2 p.m., set your clock, set your alarm, because Rich Guthrie will be back with a friend to talk about birds. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.